Hi, Jen. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Trin.
Hi, Trin.
We put some thought into this, Trin and I, and we think you two would get along.
All righty, then.
Yeah.
Welcome to I Think You Two Would Get Along, the show where the Kickstarter Games team gets two indie games creators and tries to force them to become friends in an hour or less. In this process, we're going to learn about game design, production, manufacturing, running a Kickstarter campaign, really all kinds of great things to know if you are a fan, a designer, or any other kind of huge dork like us. I'm Trin from Kickstarter, and throughout this conversation, I am going to guide you through the stages of making a friend. So we're going to start with small talk, and then we'll go into medium talk, in which we will talk about the medium of making games. And then we will end with large talk, which is going to be a set of big questions with no right answer, just some fun food for thought, some little brain munchies. With me today from the Kickstarter Games team is, for the very first time ever in this podcast history, Luke Crane.
It's great to be here. It is weird, this being my first behind the scenes. I have been, cheerleading every episode. In fact, even before there were episodes, I was rolling boulders uphill to get this podcast started. So, but I'm glad I waited because Jen and Sarah seem real awesome. And I think this is going to be great.
You are correct that this is going to be great. Luke Crane, the people know your name far and wide, but tell the people who you are, just in case.
I am the head of games at Kickstarter, and I have been for 6 years. Oh, my God. My sixth anniversary is coming up in September.
Happy anniversary.
Yeah. I also make role-playing games and other types of games, like The Burning Wheel and Mouse Guard, etc.
Great work introducing yourself, Luke Crane. And today, we have two incredibly badass guests with us. First up, there's Sarah Kennington, who currently has a game live on Kickstarter called Microbrew. Sarah, could you tell us a little bit about Microbrew?
Yeah, Microbrew is a two-player, sort of a puzzle worker placement game. It's a full-sized worker placement game, but we've put it into just a tiny little mint tin. So everything comes in this little tin so that when you open it up, it just essentially fills your table so that you can be a brewer. The aim is that, you know, you want to have the best beer that you can make so that you get the best loyal customers. And there's this wonderful little puzzle element to it where you sort of do a puzzle with the worts where you're brewing the beer that you then make recipes for and then sell to customers. So it's a fun little game. It's something you can take to a bar. Yeah, we hope people like it, and it's went well since we launched on Saturday, so it's going good.
Oh, yeah, you guys already funded.
Yeah, yeah. That was a bit of a surprise to wake up to it being funded. We're like, oh, cool.
And now Jen Ellis of Two Gather Studios, of multiple Kickstarter successes, just a wonderful warm force of good in this industry. Jen, tell us about you.
Sure. So I'm one half of Together Studios. My partner in life and my partner in business is Keith Baker. He and I make games that we love and we want to share with other people. And sometimes we make them collaboratively with other folks who are not necessarily in the world of games. So, for example, we made a game called Illimat with the band The Decembrists. We made our game Action Cats with all of our backers. So we used all of our backers' cat pictures for the game.
Truly a unique company, Together Studios. Okay, Jen and Sarah, it is time for me and Luke to get you two to know one another. So let's start with some small talk. Jen, you have a pug who is beautiful.
Really probably the most photogenic dog on the internet who doesn't have his own Instagram account.
Yeah, he's got like a little mush face. He's a good mush face boy.
He's totally snuggable. And then I have a cat named Haggis.
Yay.
Cool.
Like the pudding. And Haggis lives up to his name. He's just, he's like a pudding belly, you know, filled with sheep intestines and potato and oats. And he marches into a room like a set of bagpipes. He just like pounces on everything and he's, you know, he's around.
So, Sarah, I was going to ask you the same question. I was going to ask you about your pets. But so we're on the subject of Haggis, and I feel like we should just roll with it. So haggis, that's still a thing. Do people do that?
Oh, haggis is gorgeous. Oh, haggis is a really, really nice dish, actually. My husband has haggis on pizza.
Wait, so he puts it on his pizza, or like he calls up Domino's and orders the $9.99 haggis special? Like, is this something he has to concoct?
Not from pizza. Oh, he wouldn't buy the haggis from. We buy McSween's haggis, which is a world class haggis. It's a particular butchers that make the haggis that we tend to buy. But there's a company that called Cosmos that do pizza with haggis on it that you just buy in the supermarket.
I need to ask this, and I feel like I shouldn't, but I'm going to do it anyway. I need to ask this. As a vegan, I don't know what this tastes like, haggis. What does it taste like? Is it tangy? I feel like it would be tangy because of the organs in it.
Like haggis?
Oh, no.
No, there's a sort of, I don't know, it's quite hard to describe it. It's quite a dense texture, but it's quite a, not a sharp flavor, but
it's like a messed up pate, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah, quite a coarse yeah. style pate. Yeah, you actually, that's quite a good way to describe it. Yeah, I mean, it literally tastes of haggis.
I'm really excited that you like haggis. I feel like this is the first thing that we can bond over, because people think that I'm making fun of it or something. And I'm like, no, it really does taste good. I love it.
Yeah.
In the United States, you can't really get the same haggis that you have.
You can.
That you have over there.
You can. McSween's imports to the US.
Oh, they do now?
They do in New York.
Oh.
Maybe not Portland.
Well, I think we know what Jen will be Googling after recording.
When I was a kid, we would drive to New Jersey. So I grew up in New York. We would drive to New Jersey to a Scottish bakery to get specific, like, blood pudding, haggis,
black pudding.
Like, all of...
Did you get pudding, square sausage?
We got square sausage. We also got the meat pies, like the pasty pies, which you get, like...
Cornish pasties.
Oh, my gosh.
That sort of thing.
Yeah. But they're... So, have you ever seen the movie So I Married an Axe Murderer?
Yes. Oh, I love that.
Yeah, not only have I actually seen that entire movie, but when I was 15, I fell asleep to the VHS of So I Married an Axe Murderer every night for at least an entire 2 school years. I know it. I actually know it almost by heart.
No way.
We're really bonding over haggis over here.
I'm right there with you, Trin, but I also feel like really self-conscious that Sarah is here and I can't like do the fake Scottish accent.
Have a go.
My favorite is the Colonel Sanders thing. It's like...
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. He puts an additive chemical into his chicken that makes you crave for a nightly smartass. It's the best I got.
I love that bit.
Oh my God, it's so good. But the quote of all Scottish food is based on a dare.
That could be said of most cultures, truly.
And there are, you know, lots of chippies and a chippie's a... Do you know what a chippie is, Trin? Yeah.
No, but it sounds delicious.
A chippie is where you would get like fried food, like a fried pizza, where they take the pizza and they deep fry it, where you get like fish and chips and fried sauce. Everything is battered and then deep fried. There's a great poster that's in the Avengers movie where it was filmed in Edinburgh. And
yeah.
It's deep fried Mars bars. And they've now, the little shop that was in the movie has got a big poster up with a sort of like cracked window saying the Avengers, but it's still got the deep fried Mars bars, £2.50.
Man, that sounds so American to me. Like, if you asked me where can you get a deep fried Mars bar, I'd be like, I don't know, but I think something can be arranged at 7-Eleven. Speaking of putting ill-advised things into our bodies for fun, Sarah, your game is about beers. Do you remember your first alcoholic beverage?
I'm trying to think. So my first alcoholic drink would have probably been whiskey. Where you would have stolen it out of you would have went to a party with your parents at somebody's house, and you would have literally just picked up the glass and had a sip, and then thought, oh, that's horrible, put the glass back down, and if you were caught, you would have been scalped, which is where, you know, a parent takes a hand and hits you over the head. That would have been most likely my first alcoholic drink.
That's just bold. Like, that's super bold to have whiskey for your very first drink. That's like a level 300 beverage, I feel like.
Yeah.
Because that's what's lying about. Were you thinking, oh, I'll try that.
So was there like, people watch it, like people knew not to put their drinks down all the kids were just trying to get in their first sip? Or was it just kind of every once in a while you're like, oh, that's been sitting there for a while?
Yeah, it would have most likely have been somebody would have walked away, and you would have picked it up. I think you generally sort of try cider as your first actual alcoholic drink as a teenager, probably about 13, 14 sort of thing, because you could buy it in a 2 liter bottle.
A 2 liter bottle? Like the quantities in which I would buy Dr. Pepper. This is a beautiful place that you live in.
Yeah, that's, so you start off on like cider because it's cheap and then you work your way up.
I have a beer question for you, Sarah. What does it mean when you're in the UK and they say real ales?
What we probably use, we call it what, artisan beer, I suppose. So an ale is, an ale is warm and flat, quite frankly. I don't drink ale. But apologies to anybody listening that does drink ale. Ale tends to be served at room temperature. If you go to a real ale bar, they'll still serve the ale by pumping it.
Uh-huh.
So they'll actually have the hand pump that will pressure the drink up into the glass. And it will be crafted in small batches.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
And warm?
Yeah, well, it's room to... I prefer my beer to be chilled. I don't drink ale. But yeah, I mean, I've got loads of friends that are part of Canberra, which is the Real Ale Association.
Oddly enough, the Real Ale Association brings me pretty well to my next question. So Jen Ellis, your game Illimat is about a secret society.
Shh, yes.
Have you ever been a part of a secret society or a secret club?
Oh, boy. It's a really intense question. I don't know why I'm like having an emotional reaction to it. Where I'm like,
wait, have I?
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, I don't know.
I know that the Girl Scouts are not a secret society, but I was a pioneer girl, which is like the born again Christian version of that. It's really weird. Like there's like a whole section, like you can get earn like a makeup badge and a badge in like being a good wife. when you're like 13, there's like a lot of things about being brought up in a very religious family that were good for me, but there's a lot of things that I had to go through a lot of therapy on.
Oh yeah, I feel that. No, don't you worry. In this house, we are 100% pro mental health care, pro Girl Scouts, pro therapy.
So in the Brownies, we got badges, or we had a badge, and it was for being able to do housework. And you had the hostess badge for being able to basically lay a table and make dinner. And when you look back on it, it was, the trainings for being a good housewife.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it was also part of the time, of in the mid 80s, like we were just still doing that stuff. And I talked to the Girl Scouts today and they're like, they're getting badges for being for designing comic books and game development. So
yeah, because you get the whole book when you join the Girl Guide, and it's like this little album that you can just go through and say, "Oh, I like that badge. Oh, I like that badge."
Yeah,
and they just tell you what you need to do and what evidence you need to show, and if you're doing it to have, like, my daughter did seamstress sewing, so you had to take pictures of her actively sewing, and from the cutting out to the sewing it together to the stuffing the teddy, that sort of thing.
Right.
But you didn't have to do it in the actual guild, in your club night. You could do it
independently
and just show evidence of you actively doing it. Yeah.
Because then you're not like you're not going through the filter of a single guide and what they think that you should learn. You can independently, oh my God, I would have loved that.
Yeah,
that sounds wonderful.
Cool.
We've been talking a lot about cultural and generational differences today. And I know the three of you, Sarah, Luke, and Jen, you're all Gen X, right?
Correct.
Okay, cool. So I'm going to close out small talk by listing three millennial trends. And I want you to pick one that you can keep. So basically, you're gonna pick your favorite and the other two get sent back to the millennials, okay? All right. Subscription boxes, killing department stores, millennial pink.
Wait, millennial pink? This is a thing?
No, it's a real thing. So you know your friend Adam Skinny Ghost on Twitter?
Adam Coble, sorry.
Yeah, Skinny Ghost. Okay, so he has what would be classified as millennial pink hair. Just Google it, millennial pink. Okay, to recap, one last time, subscription boxes, killing department stores, and your friend Adam's hair color. Pick one that you're going to take away from the millennials and keep.
So wait, do I take this from the millennials and they never get to have it again? This is really important.
Yeah, you keep it and it will never be returned. This podcast has real world consequences and the millennials will never have these things back.
I'm gonna steal their subscription boxes and fill them full of strange bones and broken glass.
I know somebody who has a subscription box for a monthly bone or skeleton.
Legit, Jen, that's actually the most ambitious Gen X millennials crossover event ever undertaken, is the bone box.
No, I like the subscription boxes too, because I occasionally get the a subscription box for gin, and it's the best subscription box ever. Yeah, you get a lovely bottle of gin that you don't know what it's going to be. It's a big surprise. And you know, you get little chocolates or snacks to go with accompany that particular gin.
Can I protest this question?
You can, but then you have to think of a better last question for small talk, because this is my job and you're doing my job now.
My protest is that I'm just feeling bad for the millennials. I'm feeling bad for how much our generation, and I'm just going to say people in their 40s like me, use it as a marketing clickbait tool. I'm like really sick of all of the articles about what they did and what they destroyed, when really like capitalism was just on the decline already. And I really, and those old guys already did it. I know that this is not a serious question. It's just one of those things where I'm like,
okay, so as resident millennial, I feel my generation has a lot of kinship with Gen X. Like Gen X watched the boomers ruin everything, and now the millennials, right, we're ready to cry together. We want to get together in a nice dark room. We're going to put on The Cure and Dashboard Confessional, just a mix CD, and then we will cry together.
Yeah.
Okay, this question tanked, so let's just move on. Luke, why don't you ask these women about games?
Is there Segway music or anything? Is there like a, do we have a Segway sound effect? Wind blowing.
I can fake some segue music. Here we go.
Sarah, maybe you might. You already mentioned your live project, but really, maybe talk about. You could each talk about briefly, like your favorite project that you've run on Kickstarter. May not be your biggest, but you know, I don't know. I don't know if that's like naming your kids, like which is your favorite. But I mean, everybody has a favorite. Don't lie.
So my favorite one that we ran was probably Carcosa. So it was our second one. We were a lot more prepared for it. We had already done the first one, so we knew how to do some level of marketing. My husband made the Kickstarter page. We already had made contacts with people who knew how to do videography, how to do sound. We were a bit, you know, that bit more experienced in being able to do Facebook ads, so doing that targeted marketing. So it was all that little bit smoother, and we used the same manufacturer for our second game as our first game. So I would say that is my favourite one as a completionist from start to finish. It was, you felt as though, you know, oh, I know how to do this now. You know, this, you're more confident. More eager to engage with your backers as well. You're not as scared of your backers as you are the very first time you do a Kickstarter. You know, because you've got that first contact where people are just asking you questions, thinking, oh, I don't know the answer. I'll say nothing. With your second, if someone asks you a question, you're confident enough to say, no, we can't do that. Or, that's a fantastic idea. Let me investigate that. And it, with the second one, so with Carcosa, we made solo rules during the campaign, which was fantastic. So it literally, well, I'm saying we, my husband did the solo rules because Carcosa was his game. But he made them with a team of backers who sort of contributed ideas that then were often playtested, and then they came back and he worked through their ideas and then went back out again. And by the end of the campaign, we had solid solo rules. And I think that, as a community and as a collaborative venture that went alongside the main delivery of the game, was just fantastic. And, you know, that experience was wonderful. You walk away from that thinking, wow, you know, and we've quite a few of those people, specifically a guy called Hector, who's kept in touch and has given us a lot of feedback for Microbrew as well. You know, so he, you know, we were able to sort of send, he's not a reviewer, but we sent him a copy of Microbrew, and he playtested it with his friends and he gave us feedback. And, you know, it's great to meet people that you then become, you know, actual friends with. Which is fabulous. Yeah, I love that. You know, and that will always be special for us, because we did meet people that we've now became friends with only because we did that Kickstarter.
Jen, what about you? I would say it's been a roller coaster. I think you even entered the Kickstarter world. There was like drama.
In the very, very early years of Kickstarter, Keith, my husband and partner, gave a design to a third party company that raised money on Kickstarter and then never delivered the project. And we really wanted to make sure that that was as resolved as that could be, you know, especially as people who we didn't collect the money. So it wasn't our project. You know, we were in a position of how do we educate people that someone could design a game and have their name on it, but have nothing to do with the fundraising and how it gets executed. So I'm not going to say that that's my favorite child. but I will say, you know, Illimat was really fun because we have this voice of a secret society and we can do so many fun things. And we had these new audiences who are new to Kickstarter and who are not necessarily quote unquote gamers. You know, these are people who liked the subject matter, liked what we were doing, and they've played games in their life, but they're not someone who is, you know, your typical person who's going to back a Kickstarter game. So that was a really fun thing, and we got to do really fun things. I got to make like a how to play our game vinyl record. I mean, that was really awesome. And so it's been a really lovely gift. So
you both have jumped from kind of style to style, subject to subject, through the Kickstarter projects that you've run. Do you find that it's difficult to keep your audience engaged from project to project? Like, do you find people are saying, wait, what? Cats, what the hell is this? Or Carcosa, why would I want to go there?
You know, you've got people that will go to Come On because they're going there for the minis, or they'll go to, you know, a specific type of publisher because they like their game. But we hope that our backers follow us because they like us personally. They like our game style. They like the direction that we want to take our games in. And, you know, and the feedback that we get. You know,
I'm having a real, it comes in pints
a big
moment.
Following of Shout followed out to us you, from Lord our first game nerd. To Carcosa, and then from Carcosa into Microbrew as well. You know, so it's one of these really nice things where you can see your list of backers and recognise the names. My husband always laughs that I can actually just name half the backers. Oh yeah, do you remember this comment that such and such person said? Like, how do you know these names? Like,
that's amazing. That you are amazing. Wow, that's amazing.
It's nice, you know. It's nice to be able to recognize the people that have followed us through our journey and into our three different games, and I love that. I love the fact that people see us as part of their community, and we definitely see them as part of ours.
Mm-hmm.
Jen, like, you made three very different games on Kickstarter: Phoenix Dawn, Illimat, and Action Cats. Do you feel like your audience was also game and along for the ride for those? Or have you had to kind of start from one with each project?
You know, there's a lot of other games that they could buy off the shelf immediately. Why am I supporting you to make this? Well, it's because I get a sense of who Jen and Keith is, or who Sarah is, and from how they communicate and how they answer questions and how they handled themselves in the last campaign. And I think that's what that gets followed over. I think we get that. And I think there's been people who like really liked our other things and said, well, Action Cats isn't really a game for me, but I bought it for my niece when it came out, you know, or I'll support you. And I know that some of these games are not going to be for everybody and they're not going to be for all of our core fans, but they still support us in other ways. I'm incredibly thankful for it. And it's like Sarah said, you kind of build a community about who you are. And you have to, and I think on Kickstarter, it's a long journey. So who you are just has to be who you are. You really can't pretend to be anybody else because I think people are savvy enough to kind of push through that. And if you open it up to have them be included in the thing that you're making in some way or another, that just even goes deeper into the next thing. So
is there anything that either of you have forgotten when running a Kickstarter project where you regretted it, kicked yourself, woke up in the middle of the night saying, I forgot to...
In Illimat. So Illimat was, we started delivering on that project last November. And there was one Kickstarter reward that was an extra thing that's called the Victory Book. We had all the stuff that we had to make. I mean, there was like 15 items that we made for rewards and part of that. And we just put it all together. And this Victory Book, I was like, you know, this Victory Book could be a product, but we have to like let people... Like, why did I promise that now? like, because this could be a thing, but people have to like live with this game for a while. I want to see how people interact with it in order to make this book. This book is like a little tome of like your legacy games, and it has like interactive stuff in it. It's kind of like a little guide, and it has all these things. And I was like, I don't want to put this out now before I know people in there. And then part of me was also like, but Jen, you said you had to. And it turned out where it was just like, you know what? I have everything done. I'm just going to ship everything and we'll get the Victory Book out. We make this game and everything in it in collaboration with the band The Decemberists and Carson Ellis, who's an illustrator who works with them. And then they went on a big world tour and had an album released. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, they're not really available to make this Victory Book with me now, are they? So it's been like months and months. I have this Victory Book now done. It's going to the printer, but it's like its own thing. And now I'm like, oh, shit, getting this to people is going to be such a pain in the ass. It's currently on my Trello board of like, how the hell am I going to do this and not make myself bankrupt, right? There's just all of these cascading of effects of like small choices that you make. It's just one of those things where there's probably better ways to have done this. Oh, well, no one died, right?
Yeah, that's the important bit.
Yeah. And people who still love the game, love the game.
So, Sarah, so we can go with the original question of something that you forgot, or you could go with Jen's refinement of the question of what tiny decision that did you make on the Kickstarter campaign that had massive cascading effects further down the line and that you're still living with to this day? You choose.
I'm going to go with that one. So as part of the Carcosa campaign, we had distribution into Germany. So we thought, oh, we'll get some German rule books made, and the company did the translation, and they were buying, I think, 140 copies. But we were also going to Essen. I thought, everybody in Essen is German. We should get, you know, German copies made to give out with the game as well. And we met very, very few Germans at Essen. So we'd taken like 100 copies of this German translation book, and I think we gave away 10. And I kept saying to people, oh, are you German? We have a German. I'm not German. I'm Dutch. I'm not German. I'm Swedish. And it was more embarrassing that I could not understand people's accent. So it was like, oh, you're Western Europe. Are you German? And at one point I asked a Frenchman, and the French sound nothing like the German.
This is got a part A and a part B. So first, the part A is choose technological utopia or magical fantasy land. What's your vein of magic, right? Do you want, is technology your vein of magic, or is sorcery your vein of magic?
Oh, damn.
Sorcery. I just watched Big Trouble in Little China last night. As if by magic, you know, backers appear.
I guess magical fantasy. Yeah, I guess.
In this magical fantasy world in which you are a sorcerer of great renown, or a wizard or warlock or whatever you want to call yourself.
Summoner.
An old hag.
What or who would you summon or ensorcel or enchant to help you with your Kickstarter project? And what would be the, if they could only do one thing, right? You could summon them or create them or enchant them or charm them to do one thing for running a Kickstarter project or while you were running a Kickstarter project. So it could be like cook you dinner or something. What would it be? What would be the one thing that you would cast a spell on and what would you have them do?
Oh, getting a golem from Discworld so that he would not stop. So you could just send him out to the world. And he would go around and advertise your game, and he'd be complete, just getting in and out of every house, letting people know, leafleting, doing all the sort of things where he could just tell people, you know, basically spread the word, because he would be, you know, completely and utterly unstoppable.
So a marketing golem.
A marketing golem, yeah. With a sandwich board.
Brilliant. Brilliant. That, honestly, I have to say, that's pretty close to what my answer would be. But Jen, so now that you have a better idea of the frame here, what do you think?
The keyboard would automatically respond without any tone, as if I am answering the question for the first time with the most amount of patience. I would answer the question for the 90th time. Someone would take over my body and do that.
But it's the 2018 equivalent of like animating the broomstick to sweep up the kitchen.
It's exactly it.
Yeah.
It's exactly it.
It's animating the keyboard to answer all the comments. All right, great. Do you two have any questions for each other in the terms of like your work or the experience on Kickstarter?
I was going to ask Jen about what it was like having to work with a band that would have other work pulling them away from the game, but you've already answered that about how they went on the world tour.
I think the fact is that, you know, we have other projects kind of in progress with people who gaming is not, you know, we're pulling them from other industries, if you will. When you have someone's window, you should be totally prepared to ask them for everything that you need, because yeah, that window is going to end. Same thing with artists that you work with or someone who's editing your rules. You have to be prepared to use their time wisely. And part of that is just being a good collaborator of, no matter if it's a Grammy nominated rock band or an up and coming illustrator, using someone's time wisely as much as possible is just good collaboration stuff. And 'cause you never know what's going to happen later on.
Yeah, being prepared for when that window opens up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a good idea.
Sarah, I have a lot of... my question was really around kind of the games community in Europe and working with different languages. And so your story is that you gave is really, really intriguing to me. I was able to go to UK Games Expo this year for the first time. And
cool.
And it was really cool because I was like, oh, the consumer is different. Like how they make a decision on purchasing is different. And I was just kind of curious if you see that and any other differences.
I don't really know what the culture is in America, but over in Europe, there is very much a big thing where people come to games conventions. And the idea is that they play. It's maybe an opportunity where they haven't met with friends before, or they've got games that they own that they want to play, but they don't have enough people to play them with. So you'll have lots of people that will go to games conventions, especially in the UK, and they bring big bags of their own games to play. They have no intention of shopping. They might go to the bring and buy. So trying to engage with customers at these conventions, you've got to be able to enable them to have a flavor of playing the game. And sometimes with a demo, it's not enough. So with Microbrew, we did lots of demos. And even from that, the feedback was, oh, but I never got to play the game. I'd like to play the game before I buy the game. So it's just, I think people sort of see the buffet of games in front of them, and they want to sit down, physically sit down and play your game. And it's been able to enable people to do that whilst at the same time that you're trying to, you know, to talk to other customers, to sell to people. But for me as a designer and as a small publisher, the community in the UK of games designers is amazing. You know, you've got this wonderful community of people that are willing to share ideas, share contacts. You know, we will share contacts for reviewers, for manufacturers, for distributors, for shops. You know, you don't sort of create your little black book and thinking, ah, this is just mine. No one else will know about these shops. You know, it is a case of, oh, these shops buy independently. Oh, I'll tell all the other people I know that also makes games that sell independently, that they too can go to these shops and try and sell their games. You know, as well as getting into, we have distribution through Asmodee UK as well. But it's nice as a community for everybody to speak to one another. And for us, when we go to the conventions, it's as much that level of networking and communication which we look for, as well as being able to then engage with our customers, because they see the same reviewers. So if they see our game reviewed on, say, Board Game Exposure, or through Nick Wixford's, or through Jason Froes through their channels, they'll say, oh, I saw you on your game on Jason's channel. Oh, can I now have a look at your game? And that's quite nice, that people have a conversation around the way that they found you through the internet and then come and look at your game. So it's slightly different when we were in Gen Con. It was very much a case of, you know, do you have a ticket to come in? No, go away. It's like, oh, okay.
Don't get Luke started on ticketing at Gen Con.
It's my favorite thing.
Oh my gosh, you guys are precious. You guys are really getting along. Just in the interest of time, because it's like we have 20 more minutes left in the studio, let's do some final wrap-up questions and then get you guys on your way. Sound good?
No.
Great. Okay, so now this is Large Talk. So I'm going to just give you guys three different statements that I've heard creators make, like not just game creators, but like writers and people who paint and all this stuff. And I want you to tell me whether you think that these like tried and true statements are accurate or not. Okay, first one. Accurate or not, create drunk, edit sober.
No, I create nothing when I'm drunk. Apart from a lot of hassle to my husband.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Accurate or not, make games for yourself, not for an audience.
It's inaccurate for me. I can only say that I definitely think of who is this game for from a 10,000 foot view. And all of that. I'm always in that audience because I have to play that game probably every single day for several years. But I definitely think of the other people and how they approach it.
Yes, I think it's sort of true in the sense that you, design-wise, you're more in tune with the games that you like because you play them more. So, like worker placement games. I really like worker placement games, which is why when we've made Microbrew, it was an easy collaboration because there's mechanics that we knew well. So you're very much aware of how the mechanic works. You're very much aware of how another player will interact every time you make a design decision. Whereas games that you're not familiar with aren't difficult, but they're different to make. I think there's some concept to maybe the way you would start a project. But you've always got to look at is out there? What current games, what is the temperature of the gaming community and the games that they're after?
I think it's accurate. And it's funny, even for the exact reason that Jen used, I think you should make games for yourself because you're going to have to play them every day for a few years. And if you do not love that game, you do not want to play that game, if you're not excited to play that game every day, then that's going to be a long couple years.
Last one, accurate or not, there is no reliable way to split work evenly between two co-creators.
I've thought of this question a lot because, and I'm sure Sarah would agree in some ways, when you're creating a project with your significant other, you have to tread very carefully. And I think there's no, and like any relationship, it can never really be even all the time. And there's going to be some times where someone's going to be doing the heavier lifting than another person. And I think that's just the nature of relationships, that everyone is giving what they can, but sometimes one is more work than the other.
And ultimately, it's all about skill sets as well. So for us, once we've got to the point, we have a game. You're thinking, oh, right, we have a game. Nigel, who's my husband, it does all the heavy lifting. He probably does about 85% of the work up until the point that we're going to manufacturing. So to the point when we fund, and it's like, this is the volume of games that we're going to make. Because Nigel does all the technical work. He does all the... make sure that we've got all the advertising in. I mean, I'll do some Facebook things and that, but he will do the Reddit campaigns, the Facebook campaigns. He does all of the graphics. He makes all of the web page and the Kickstarter page. And any of the artwork that would possibly, that where we haven't used a professional artist, if he's maybe had to manipulate the files that have came back, he does all of this in Illustrator. Whereas when we get to the point that, okay, we're about to make the game, up to that stage, I've done the business and the project management. And then from the point of us having the game, I have all that communication with the manufacturing, I have all the communication with logistics, with fulfillment, with the backers, which is probably why I know all their names. That work, which Nigel calls hard work, whereas I would say the work that he does is the hard work.
But speaking of working together with people, I feel that today the four of us have worked together to make a great podcast. Good work, everyone.
Yay!
So let's do one last thing. So let's just remind everybody where you can be found on the internet if you want to be found. Sarah, how about you go first? So where can people find you and your project on the internet? And if you can give us like another short description of it, that'd be awesome.
Okay, so Microbrew can be found on Kickstarter. Yay! It's been on there since Saturday, so you just search for Microbrew. We also have a Microbrew page on Facebook, and we can be found at onefreeelephant.co.uk online, or at onefreeelephant on Twitter. A wee quick description of the game is it's a minting game. It's where you play a brewer trying to be the best brewer against your opponent. It's a little puzzle game, and it's also a worker placement game where you do things like where you brew your beer, where you bottle your beer. You've got to then sell it to customers and make sure it's a recipe that they like, or you've got to advertise to them so that they enjoy the brand that you're selling. It's only a two-player game at the moment. We are working on solo rules at the request of our backers. And it can be played by three to four people if you have two tins. There's an option there to combine both the tins. So it's a great little game that you can actually carry about where you're just playing with your friend or your partner. But if you meet up with another couple, you can all play the one game together. So I like that that concept where you're not having to wait to meet a friend to play a game, that you can both still play the game and then join up for a slightly bigger game. But yeah, that's Microbrew.
So Jen, tell us where we can find you on the internet.
Wonderful. So we are Together Studios. That's T-W-O, Together. And we are available at togetherstudios.com. But follow us on Kickstarter, because our next project comes out in October. And that project is Action Pups. And we are looking for you and your pups to be a part of the game. Action Pups is a storytelling game about the secret life of dogs, in which you take story cards and compete to tell the best story. I like to call it, or people call it, it's like Cards Against Humanity with dogs. And the answer is yes. But it is family friendly and a little bit more storytelling. We are also on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook at Together Studios. That's T-W-O, Together Studios. And our games Illimat and Action Cats and Phoenix Dawn Command are available at your local fine retailers in the UK and the US, Canada, and Australia, as well as Amazon and our website.
Thank you to everyone who listened to this podcast. If you listen to this podcast and you like this podcast, why not tell your friend who's thinking about running a Kickstarter to go to ithinkyoutwowouldgetalong.com to get some information about running Kickstarters. If you are a person who is a game creator, if you're new to Kickstarter or a veteran and you'd like to be on the show, please email me at trin@kickstarter.com. Thank you to Matt Connolly for our theme song. Thank you to Alex Cox for running the studio. And thank you to all three of you. I feel like everyone got along today. This was delightful.
Thanks for podcasting, y'all.